everyone, and welcome to episode 122 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Sobalski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. Well, it is back to school time for all sorts of people, and so it's a busy time for me as well as a parent. So this week's episode is going to be a little bit off the cuff. It's going to be sort of medieval story time in that I'm going to be reading to you from some primary sources, but these are not actually stories. They are sources that have to do with what it was like to go to medieval university. I think that a lot of you probably already know that the university as we know it today has its roots in the medieval university system. I mean, it's similar to what people were doing in ancient Greece, where they were going to often a different city to learn from a specific person on a specific topic. So that is kind of something that had been done for many years, but it kind of crystallized in the Middle Ages around the idea of having a bunch of professors that might be in one place that we're talking about one thing. Now, what were they actually talking about at medieval university? Well, it wasn't such a wide range of subjects like you have today, where you can take pretty much anything, any subject you like. In the Middle Ages, you were basically there at university to study one of three things: theology, law, or medicine. And again, this is something that still resonates today in that we have a separate law school, we have a separate med school, and we have schools of divinity that give you degrees above the ones that you might get as an undergraduate. So you are learning theology, law, or medicine, and you can do that in all sorts of cities across Europe, including Paris and Oxford, of course, Cambridge, Bologna, in Salerno as well, if you're studying medicine. So all sorts of different university towns across Europe were places where you could go as a student to learn theology, law, or medicine. Often you pick your university based on what school you wanted to go to in terms of, is it a theology school? Is it a law school? Is it a medical school? But you would also pick based on who you wanted to learn from. So really it was based around the people who were teaching. You'd want to go and learn from a specific person. We know that a lot of thinkers who were teaching in medieval university were stirring up trouble sometimes in their ideas about theology, especially. There's lots of teachers that you could bring up as being troublemakers, but we're not going to focus on those today. We're going to talk about more of the institution and a little bit of what it was like. So what people might not know about medieval university is that it was fully a religious institution. So the people who were going to study there were people who had been brought up in a church school, whether that was at a monastery or cathedral school. They had been enmeshed in religion, in Christianity, their entire educational lives, and that continued. So when we think about medieval university, it is in no way separable from the church and what the church was teaching. So it's very much a religious institution in the Middle Ages. So I mention this because I'm going to be reading to you from a couple of primary sources that tell university students how they should behave, and then I'm going to be reading to you from a couple of sources that tell you how people did behave at university. So you'll see how these things are similar and different. And I think that there's a lot of similarities to the type of advice a parent or an elder might be giving to someone who's leaving home for the first time to study away, and how people do react when they have a whole lot of freedom. So I hope that you'll enjoy some of the selections I've brought forth for you, but you'll definitely see a religious bent as I read them to you. So the first source I'm going to read to you is from the Chartulary of the University of Paris, and it was written by Robert de Sorbonne. This translation is by L. Thorndike, and this one is really based on type of behavior that Sorbonne wants to have from university students. So we can imagine whether people actually follow this or not. So there's a little bit in here that is kind of boring about eating and who should pay for the food. But I think it's really interesting when we think of it in terms of kind of a cultural study. What was it like? So I'm going to read to you from the selection from the Chartulary of Paris. I wish that the custom which was instituted from the beginning in this house by the council of good men may be kept, and if anyone ever has transgressed it, that henceforth he shall not presume to do so. No one, therefore, shall eat meat in the house on Advent, nor on Monday or Tuesday of Lent, nor from Ascension Day to Pentecost. Also, I will that the community not be charged for meals taken in rooms. If there cannot be equality, it is better that the fellow eating in his room be charged than the entire community. Also, no one shall eat in his room except for cause. If anyone has a guest, he shall eat in hall. If, moreover, it shall not seem expedient to the fellow to bring that guest to hall, let him eat in his room, and he shall have the usual portion for himself, not for the guest. If, moreover, he wants more for himself or his guest, he should pay for it himself. Also, the fellow should be warned by the bearer of the roll that those eating in private rooms conduct themselves quietly and abstain from too much noise, lest those passing through the court and street be scandalized, and lest the fellows in rooms adjoining be hindered in their studies. Also, those eating in private rooms shall provide themselves with what they need in season as best they can, so that the service of the community may be disturbed as little as possible. But if there are any infringers of the statute who are accustomed to eat in private rooms without cause, they shall be warned by the bearer of the roll to desist, which if they will not do, he shall report it to the master. If, moreover, other reasons arise for which anyone can eat in a private room, it shall be left to the discretion of the roll bearer and proctors until otherwise ordered. Also, the rule does not apply to the sick. If anyone eats in a private room because of sickness, he may have a fellow with him, if he wishes, to entertain and wait on him, who shall also have his due portion. What shall be the portion of a fellow shall be left to the discretion of the dispenser. If a fellow shall come late to lunch, if he comes from classes or a sermon or business of the community, he shall have his full portion, but if from his own affairs, he shall have bread only. Also, all shall wear closed outer garments, nor shall they have trimmings of vair or grease or of red or green silk on the outer garment or hood. Also, no one shall have loud shoes or clothing by which scandal might be generated in any way. Also, no one shall be received in the house unless he shall be willing to leave off such and to observe the aforesaid rules. Also, no one shall be received in the house unless he pledges faith that if he happens to receive books from the common store, he will treat them carefully as if his own, and on no condition remove or lend them out of the house, and return them in good condition whenever required or whenever he leaves town. Also, let every fellow have his own mark on his clothes, and one only, and different from the others, and let all the marks be written on a schedule, and over each mark the name of whose it is, and let that schedule be given to the servant, so that he may learn to recognize the mark of each one. And the servant shall not receive clothes from any fellow unless he sees the mark, and then the servant can return his clothes to each fellow. Also, for peace and utility, we propound that no secular person living in town, scribe, corrector, or anyone else, unless for great cause, eat, sleep in a room, or remain with the fellows when they eat, or have frequent conversation in the gardens or hall or other parts of the house, lest the secrets of the house and the remarks of the fellows be spread abroad. Also, no outsider shall come to accountings or special meetings of the fellows, and he whose guest he is shall see to this. Also, no fellow shall bring in outsiders frequently to drink at commons, and if he does, he shall pay according to the estimate of the dispenser. Also, no fellow shall have a key to the kitchen. Also, no fellow shall presume to sleep outside the house in town, and if he did so for reason, he shall take pains to submit his excuse to the bearer of the roll. Also, no women of any sort shall eat in the private rooms. If anyone violates this rule, he shall pay the assessed penalty, namely, sixpence. Also, no one shall form the habit of talking too loudly at table. Whoever, after he has been warned about this by the prior, shall have offended by speaking too loudly, provided this is established afterwards by testimony of several fellows to the prior, shall be held to the usual house penalty, namely, 2 quarts of wine. So this is a good source, I think, because it tells you all sorts of things about this. Table manners being especially important. Who is going to pay for everything? Of course, it's something that universities are still concerned with now. But things like keeping the reputation of the university intact, especially this is talking about a college, so a smaller group within the university of people who are living in close quarters, eating together. The type of thing that you have in a college now, especially when it's one that's attached to a dormitory. So very similar to what you see in universities now, although the university doesn't usually have a dress code saying don't wear flashy stuff because it's going to distract people and bring shame on the institution. The thing about the library books is definitely recognizable, and I can totally get behind that, making sure that people bring back their books before they leave town, something that is really important even 1,000 years later. One thing that I especially like about this source also is the fact that there is laundry being taken into account, which is why they have to create a chart that shows whose clothes are whose, and they have to put a mark inside their clothing. This suggests that the person who's doing the laundry doesn't know how to read, wouldn't know how to read the names that were stitched in it. It's easier for people to just stitch a mark. And this is probably something that has to do with the fact that the person who's doing it may not be literate, or it might be more than one person doing the laundry. So you might have, it says just servant, but you might have different servants on different days. And so you don't have to worry about them recognizing whose clothes are whose. Just put a mark on your clothes and the servant will make sure that you get your clothes back. So this is one from the University of Paris. I thought it was a really interesting source and I wanted to bring that one to you. The next source I wanted to read to you is from the Morales Scholarium, and it's by John of Garland. And this translation is by L.J. Pato, which I hope I've said correctly. One of the challenges of working in an audio format is really making sure that you've pronounced everybody's name correctly and all the Latin, the French, the German, whatever it happens to be that day. So hopefully I'm pronouncing things correctly, but you never know. So this one is about how students should behave, and it's longer. So, I mean, you can skip ahead if you like, but this has a lot of information about what was expected not only of students, but of people in general. And so I thought about skipping the part about table manners, but I really think table manners are interesting. So I'm going to bring this to you as well. So here we go. Learn how to entertain at table, to provide food and the sauces that go with the various dishes, and to serve seasonable wine in modest quantity. Once again, I touch critically on manners in polite society so that my readers may become more genteel. According to good custom, you should place the sauce on the right, the service plate on the left. You should have the servant take the first course to him who sits at the head of the table. Take hold of the base of a goblet so that unsightly finger marks may not show on the side. Polite diners pause over their cup, but gluttons, who live like mules and weevils, empty it with one draught. Pour wine properly with both hands so as not to spill any. Always serve 2 pieces of bread. Have several well-dressed servants in readiness to bring clean towels and to supply the wants of the guest. Lest I should seem to be in charge of the cooks like Nebuzaradan, I shall not go into the art of preparing fine dishes. Carve the meats which are not to be served in the broth, and skillfully take off the wings of fowl while they are hot. He who takes a walk or a brief nap after dinner preserves his health. If you wish to regain your strength as a convalescent and keep your health when you are well, drink moderately. All Epicureans live impure lives. They lose their eyesight, they are rude, unclean, and are doomed to die a sudden death. The sage of Miletus set down these rules of polite behavior for which we should be grateful. Regulate your household soberly. Do your civic duties cheerfully. Have a word of greeting for strangers as for friends. Do your utmost to avoid altercations with irate associates. With a smile and a witticism, cover up the faults of others. Be faultless at table, glad even to entertain your enemies. Bear your misfortunes with fortitude and do not let your head be turned by good fortune. Make an effort to follow these 7 rules of courtliness. May you be decked out with them, you who declare yourself to be a scholar. Unless you have such urbanities, you are taken for a rustic. Even though you be Socrates, if you have rude manners, you are a ditch digger. Avoid these 7 rusticities which are signaled by Thales the sage. Light-minded talk is unseemly at table. So is presumption and constant contention. It is rude to be ungrateful or cruel towards the poor. It is reprehensible to be haughty towards your dear friends. If you reject good advice, you are a fool. And you lack the light of reason if you fly in the face of God. These good precepts are not hidden away, but are written in the public theater. Avoid these things, lest you be consigned behind the gates of hell. You will be courteous if you perform the following works of mercy. If at night you give beds to the poor, if you heal the sick, if you clothe the freezing, give food to the beggar, console the afflicted, and offer drink to the thirsty. Regard as models of deportment the graven images of the churches which you should carry in your mind as living and indelible pictures. Cherish again the violets of civility without blemish so that when your blindness has vanished, the eyes of your soul may have no wasting disease. Be not a fornicator, O student, a robber, a murderer, a deceitful merchant, a champion at dice. In the choir stalls, a cleric should chant without noise and commotion. I advocate that the ordinary layman who does not sing be kept out of the choir. A student, who is a churchman, is expected to follow good custom, to be willing to serve, to fee the notary who has drawn up a charter for him, to gladden the giver. Do not constantly urge your horse on with a spur, which should be used only on rare occasions. Give your horse the reins when he mounts an incline. Fearing a serious accident, avoid crossing swollen rivers or the Rhine. If a bridge is not safe, you should dismount and let the horse pick his way over the smooth parts. Mount gently on the left stirrup. Select beautiful equestrian trappings suitable to your clerical station. Ride erect unless you are bent by age. If you are of the elect, you should have a rich saddle cloth. The cross should be exalted, the voice be raised in prayer, Christ should be worshipped, the foot should be taken out of the stirrup. The horseman will descend from his horse and say his prayers. No matter how far he then will travel, he will ride in safety. He who wishes to serve should not be quick, not go to sleep, and not give way to anger against his lord. Avoid drunkards, those who indulge in secret sin, those who like to beat and strike, those who love lewdness, evil games, and quarrels. Passing a cemetery, if you are well-bred, and if you hope for salvation, you pause to pray that the dead may rest in peace. Have nothing to do with the prostitute, but love your wife. All wives should be honored, but especially those who are distinguished by virtue. A person who is well should not recline at table in the fashion of the ancients. When you walk after dinner, keep on frequented streets. Avoid insincere speeches. Unless you wish to be considered a fool, learn to keep your mouth shut in season. Stand and sit upright. Do not scratch yourself. As I was reading that, I was thinking a lot about the kind of stream of consciousness advice that is coming out of this passage. And it reminded me a lot of the things that we heard a lot in the 90s, where it was Life's Little Instruction Book, where that song that was just a whole litany of advice, wear sunscreen being the most important one. And so this is kind of, like I said, it's stream of consciousness advice, but it's got a whole bunch of stuff in it that's really interesting. One of the things being that the students should consider themselves elevated already above other people. And from that position, they should be courteous to the people who are lower. But it's all about, you don't want to be a rustic. So you don't want to look like a peasant. And a lot of this has to do with table manners. But there are some assumptions in there that have to do with having horses or having enough money to buy things to dress up your horse. This is something that is not necessarily common to all of the students at a university. Even if they're traveling to go to university, they might be doing that on foot or borrowing a horse. They might not have horses of their own. So this is what I mean when it's talking about getting at advice for more than just students, people in general. The other thing that it mentions that might not be applicable to a lot of students at university is the part about wives. Many of these men are not going to be married at this point. They might be putting aside marriage while they're doing their schooling, or they might never actually marry because they will go into a career in the church. So the stuff about wives is, I think, mainly just a part of this spouting off of advice for everyone. But you do definitely see this religious bent in this, where he's saying a student is a churchman. He's expected to be singing in choir, and he's got to do this in a way that is very dignified and that doesn't bring any shame on people. One of the things that you might not realize is some of the people who are at university are not just independent scholars. They're not just people who are sent on their own, but often you have monks and friars as well who are going off to study, that have been sent by their order to go and study at university. So those people are definitely going to be the people who are in the room next door saying, don't eat too loudly with your guests, as we talked about when we were listening to the passage by Robert Sobon. One of the things that medieval students were known for, at least in the contemporary sources by people outside of the university usually, was students were known for stirring up trouble. So we've just had a couple sources that talk about how a student should behave. There are lots of sources that talk about how students did behave, and not all of those are flattering. So one of the ways that students stirred up trouble was in fighting, actual physical fighting. This is something that we have a lot of accounts of. In fact, there was a lot of tension often between what we now call town and gown. So the people of the town and the people of the university might be sparring against each other over all sorts of things. The people of the town might be saying that the students are too noisy, they're disruptive, they are drinking too much, they're destroying property, that kind of thing. The type of stuff that we hear today. And then the students would be complaining about things like the town is overcharging them for food, for rent, for all sorts of things. We're just giving them disrespect. So these are things that we still kind of hear when we hear about clashes between town and gown now in university towns. But this is something that students were known for doing, sometimes getting too rowdy, at least by the accounts of the townspeople. The most famous example is perhaps the University of Cambridge being founded, because there is a huge fight between town and gown in Oxford that led to most of Oxford's scholars and teachers leaving the town and founding a new university in Cambridge. We also have accounts of infighting within universities. We know that a lot of people were traveling to university, as I've said, and sometimes you'd have groups of people who were from one area and they might be mixing it up with people from another area. I think it's Adam of Usk that mentions that he, as a Welshman, was fighting against other people in a different faction. So there's a lot of infighting going on within the university, plus all the usual complaints that people still make against university students, saying that they are overindulging in alcohol, perhaps being too promiscuous. This is something that's familiar to us now, but also definitely leveled charges that were leveled at university students in the Middle Ages because they were meant to be clerics. So you do see that a lot. So this seems like the perfect time to bring more of a first-person perspective to the podcast about what it was like to be a university student. So I'm going to read to you a poem by a troubadour, a minstrel called Roux de Boeuf. He wrote a whole bunch of stuff in his day. Most of it was pretty biting, so you can expect that from this as well. I don't know if this is based on personal experience or things he's heard from students or other people, but he is talking about what it's like to be a scholar in Paris. So I hope you enjoy this one. This is a translation by M.E. Markley. Much argument is heard of late, the subject I'll attempt to state. A question for dispute, I fear, that will hang on for many a year. The student folk of Paris town, I speak of those in cap and gown, students of art, philosophy, in short, the university, and not our old-time learned men, have stirred up trouble here again. Nothing they'll gain, it seems to me, except more bitter enmity. Till there is no peace, day or night, does such a state of things seem right? To give his son a chance to stay in Paris, growing wise each day, is some old peasant's one ambition. To pay his bills and his tuition, the poor hard-working father slaves, sends him each farthing that he saves, while he in misery will stay on his scant plot of land to pray that his hard toil may help to raise his son to honor and to praise. But once the son is safe in town, the story then reads upside down. Forgetting all his pledges now, the earnings of his father's plow, he sends for weapons, not for books. Brawling through city streets, he looks to find some pretty loitering wench, or idle brawl by tavern bench. Wanders at will and pries about, till money fails and gown wears out. Then he starts fresh on the old round. Why sow good seed on barren ground? Even in Lent, when men should do something pleasing in God's view, your students then elect to wear for penitence no shirts of hair, but swaggering hauberks as they sit, drowning in drink their feeble wit, while three or four of them excite 400 students to a fight and close the university. Not such a great calamity. Yet heavens, for one of serious mind, what life more pleasing can you find than earnest scholar's life may be? More pains than precious gems has he, and while struggling to grow wise, amusements he must sacrifice, give up his feasting and his drinking, and spend his time in sober thinking. His life is just about as merry as monks is in a monastery. Why send a boy away to school, there to become an errant fool? When he should be acquiring sense, he wastes his time and all his pence, and to his friends brings only shame, while they suppose him winning fame. So this is obviously a pretty cynical look at university life by Roux de Boeuf. It's totally expected when it comes to him. There are a bunch of things that I like about this poem. One of them is the peasant father who has ambitions for his son, and that's why he sends him to university. And this is absolutely a true thing that happened, where if you were of lower status, you could go to university and you could get a career in the church if you were an apt student. And sometimes there were colleges where students were sponsored by a benefactor, so that even if they didn't have any money, they could go to school. So patronage in the form of your room and board being paid for and your books and your tuition and all of that stuff. So if you're a peasant, this was definitely a way that you could send your son out of poverty and give him a better life. So I like that part of the poem. Of course, it's also very funny with its completely cynical view of what it was like to be a student being a brawler, especially in Lent, how scandalous, but also the actual life of a student who's very studious being pretty tedious and monastic at times. I think these are the polar opposites that you still see in university life today, the people who are just letting loose now that they are away from their parents, and also the people that are just studying and doing nothing else. So I think that that is kind of a fun look at it as well. Finally, I thought I would bring to you a couple of letters that were written by students to their parents. So we talked about the expense of university. We talked about how a peasant might be scrimping and saving to make sure that his son has enough to go to school. There were a lot of expenses in university back in the day, just as there are now. I mean, expense is definitely something that goes hand in hand with university. So the type of stuff that a student would be expected to pay for, not only his room and board, but his food, he would have to pay for his clothes as well. So he'd have to pay for a robe and shoes. There's always things about shoes and stockings where people are asking for more money for shoes and stockings. They also had to pay for ink and quills. Most of their notes, quick notes, could be done on a wax tablet, but they would be taking notes in their textbooks around the edges, so glossing the textbook. So they would be buying textbooks as well. And in one of the very first episodes of the Medieval Podcast, I talked with Eric Wackel about what type of books you could have in the Middle Ages. And he mentioned that students often had a soft cover. So they wouldn't have boards on their books. They just have a soft leather cover to make it cheaper for them. But sometimes textbooks were still really expensive because you'd have only a small square of the text that you're reading, that you're meant to read and study within the page, and then a whole bunch of blank space around it for you to write your notes on it. So you'd have to pay for your books, you'd have to pay for your ink and your quills, and all of those things as well. You'd also want to be able to pay to have a good time, go out to the pub every once in a while with your friends. So I think that is totally cool. Something that every student should be able to do is go and hang out with your friends sometimes. And that is an expense too. So one of the most fun sources that we have from the Middle Ages when it comes to university is letters that students have written home to their parents asking for more money. And this really kind of gets at the fact that the more things change, the more they stay the same, because university is expensive and you do need to sometimes write home to your parents to get them to send you more money. So here are a couple of letters from students to their parents. The first one is just kind of brief. The student needs more money, so here is his letter to his dad. B to his venerable master A, greeting. This is to inform you that I am studying at Oxford with the greatest diligence, but the matter of money stands greatly in the way of my promotion, as it is now 2 months since I spent the last of what you sent me. The city is expensive and makes many demands. I have to rent lodgings, buy necessaries, and provide for many other things which I cannot now specify. Wherefore, I respectfully beg your paternity that by the promptings of divine pity you may assist me so that I may be able to complete what I have well begun. For you must know that without Ceres and Bacchus, Apollo grows cold. And that's a cool one because you have references to classical learning to kind of punctuate the fact that the student is learning, definitely learning stuff. He just needs a bit more money to do it. And then the next one, these are both in an article on medievalist.net, which I'll give you the link to. And there's a third one as well. But this one I think is funny because it's being written by a couple of brothers and they are really kind of almost working too hard to convince their parents that they are doing well at school and that the parents should send money. So this is just one that I think is funny, I thought I would bring to you. To their very dear and respectable parents, M. Matron Knight and M. his wife, M. and S., their sons, send greetings and filial obedience. This is to inform you that by divine mercy, we are living in good health in the city of Orléans and are devoting ourselves wholly to study, mindful of the words of Cato, to know anything is praiseworthy. We occupy a good dwelling next door but one to the schools and marketplace so that we can go to school every day without wetting our feet. We also have good companions in the house with us, well advanced in their studies and of excellent habit, an advantage which we well appreciate. For as the psalmist says, with an upright man thou wilt show thyself upright. Wherefore, lest production cease from lack of material, we beg your paternity to send us by the bearer, B, money for buying parchment, ink, a desk, and other things which we need in sufficient amount that we may suffer no want on your account, God forbid, but finish our studies and return home with honor. The bearer will also take charge of the shoes and stockings which you have to send us, and any news as well. So I love this one because they're like, hey, our roommates are great. They're very studious, just like us. We're super studious. Did we mention we're studious? And they're quoting from Cato and the Psalms, which again emphasizes the fact that they're learning what they're there to study, which is brilliant. I do think that it's also very cute and very human that they mention that they are just a couple doors down from the school and the marketplace so that their feet don't even get wet. So like, don't worry, mom, we're okay. We're not going to get sick because we're not even getting wet. It's beautiful. And then they mention that the bearer will bring back shoes and stockings from home. So they're expecting that their parents will be sending them shoes and stockings so that they can be warm as they study. It's just a very cute look, I think, at family relations in the Middle Ages. And the fact that I often hear people talk about whether or not medieval people love their children. And again, I think this is a good example that shows that there is a good relationship between the parents and the kids, even in the way that the kids might be trying to manipulate their parents, perhaps by being unbelievably good in this letter. Although I might be a complete cynic and maybe they are brilliant students and I should stop being so cynical. But I like to read it this way because, well, to me, it's a lot more fun. So I hope you've enjoyed these few primary sources that tell us a little bit about what life is like at medieval university. I love primary sources not only because I feel like they bring me closer to the people of the past, but they also show you, I think as listeners, what historians are working with when they're trying to reconstruct what things were like back in the day. And this sometimes comes from books of manners, from letters from people, from cynical poems by troubadours. All of these things contribute to our overall picture of what life was like. And so I thought that this might be a perfect opportunity to have a look at medieval university life as we go into a new semester. And I want to, of course, wish everyone the best of luck with this semester. I know it's going to be challenging for all of us going back to school this year. Parents, students, teachers, everyone. This is going to be a challenging time. So, of course, I wish you all the best and I hope that you have a happy and safe and healthy return to school this year. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's going on, Peter?
Hey. Well, we did a report on one of the plenary sessions from the International Medieval Congress from last July, and it's a paper that examined the Yellow River in China and how the Northern Song Dynasty was trying to contain the river and make sure there wasn't flooding in the 11th century. And they made huge efforts to kind of keep control of the river, but it all seemed to kind of backfire and it caused a lot of environmental damage. So a very interesting look at that large history, environmental history. So we have that. Also, Kate Stevenson is telling us about dueling divas and the celebrity fandom in the 9th century. And we also have our third installment of James Turner's series on Harald Hardrada. He's looking this time at Kievan Rus.
Wow, that's a whole range of stuff. That's really exciting.
yeah, we got that. Also, we're starting to bring in news correspondence. So we've got one based in Turkey and one based in Poland. So in the new month, you should start reading pieces from them, like the latest medieval news is coming out of those areas. We get a lot of news from the United Kingdom, places like that. Obviously, we check out the Canadian stuff here. But if you're in like another part of Europe or Asia or Africa, and you want to kind of help us cover medieval news, send us a line.
That's amazing. That's a really good idea, Peter, and I'm glad you're reaching out to people. I think that people don't realize that medievalist.net is a super small operation. It's basically Peter. Yeah. And so it's great that you're having people that are giving you news from all over the world. That's awesome.
Yeah. If you're interested kind of joining up, let us know by email or, you know, send us a message on social media and we'll talk to you.
Right. Awesome. So for people who don't know, the email address is medievalist.net@gmail.com. And then I always tell everyone where to find medievalist.net at the end of the episode. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks.
Thank you, as always, to our patrons on patreon.com for all your support. Patrons of the Medieval Podcast can choose from all sorts of amazing stuff like subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine and the Medieval Magazine, membership in our book club, and our super cool maps by Tina Ross. To find out how to become a patron of the Medieval Podcast, please visit patreon.com/medievalists. And speaking of back to school, it's time for a new session of the Medieval Masterclass for Creators. It's a 6-week online course that I put together with some amazing experts to help people creating medieval fiction to get all those little details they need without having to spend hours lost on the internet. We cover everything from cooking to combat, blacksmithing to textile work, and we do it all with video demonstrations, helpful bibliographies, recipes, and writing prompts. You can even ask me anything. The next class begins Friday, September 17th. For all the details, please visit medievalmasterclass.com. For everything from the Yellow River to Saffron, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalist. You can find me, Danielle Cebulski, on social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5-Minute Medievalist. And you can find all my books at your favorite online bookstores, where you can even pre-order the new one, How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life, which comes out in October. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an awesome day.